and welcome to the Houston Innovators Podcast. I'm Natalie Harms, editor of Innovation Map. My guest for today is Moji Karimi, CEO and co-founder of Symvita, a biotech company with a few different climate tech applications for the energy industry. Symvita has had a lot of wins in 2023, and Moji joins the show to discuss those, plus what his plans are for further commercialization of gold, hydrogen, sustainable aviation fuel, and more. He also shares some of his observations from COP28 and advice for founders looking to grow their corporate partnerships in 2024. Moji, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be back.
I think the first time we were on the podcast was actually in 2021, but the first ever story I had on Innovation Map about Symvita was in January of 2019. So it's always fun to catch up with you because I feel like I've had a front row seat watching Symvita grow and develop over the years. And now is a exceptionally fun time to talk to you since 2023 was a huge year for Symvita, I feel like. And we're going to get to some of those highlights, but I wonder how you think of those past 5 to 6 years of growing this company. It's just like a fun time of year to reminisce. What do you think of when you think back to Symvita's journey?
Well, first of all, I think you've been an extension of the team. So every time there's good news, you're one of the first people to know about it. And in ways, you've kind of lived the Symvita journey alongside with us. So thanks for your support of Symvita and all the other entrepreneurs in Houston. When I think about the past few years, it just how important the process is as opposed to fixating on a specific goal, because that changes. Like, think about how much the market dynamics have changed around energy transition. And at the time, climate tech was not a thing. Like, that's not what people were calling it. And then, you know, boom, 2021. And so that became a category. You have this new momentum from the West Coast to the East Coast and just changed things. So alongside of that, we tried to basically find our path forward, and our mission had to stay the same, but a lot of the learnings along the way. And I've learned this, it's just the process of becoming good at the process as opposed to the fixating on a specific end goal. So that's been interesting. And I'm very happy where we have landed with this pathway that we have forward, very confident in the capabilities of the team, the partnerships that we built along the way, and super excited about what's ahead, 2024 and beyond.
As you mentioned, I've covered Symvita a lot. There's a lot of headlines, especially this year, I feel like. And so just for those catching up, I'm sure a lot of people listening are familiar with Symvita, but tell me about what the company looks like today. How big is your team? You know, what's your footprint here in Houston? What stage is the company in, as you would describe it?
Yeah, as a whole, I would say, we're about 75 people, about 60 of those in Houston, in our CO2 utilization, carbon utilization business, as well as hydrogen, gold hydrogen. And then our biomining team, Endolith, is in Denver. That's about 15 people. As far as a stage, one thing that has changed since we've talked, we used to be one company as a platform. And since then, we have spun out Gold Hydrogen as its own company called Gold H2 Inc. And we've spun out our mining business called Endolith Inc. So Gold H2 raised a seed round, is doing a Series A now. Endolith is doing a seed round, and Symvita Parent is a Series B company. So we call those our childs. You could think of them, one is in college, the other one is in high school, and they're on the way to be fully independent in the years to come.
Yeah, I think that is something that's big and different, is this evolution of multiple companies under this umbrella. And really, it kind of sets you up for a good opportunity, since you've had all these lessons learned in Symvita. So now you're able to kind of learn and bring those, learnings into the new companies, right?
Exactly. And that was the point in when, our vision for bringing inertial biotech to energy transition, we were on this journey across the past 5 to 6 years to find those applications where it makes sense to do that, where it's economical to do that. And we found it in bioleaching of copper. We found it in subsurface production of hydrogen, natural hydrogen, and a CO2 conversion. But when you want to grow those companies beyond the initial proving out the science, they have to go deep into that vertical, whether if it's upstream or if it's mining, and that becomes quite specialized. So we use the common platform and the foundation of Sambita, a lot of the back of the office services to help them basically not have to worry about that and just focus about the technology. And now they get to stand on their own and basically grow faster compared to if they were to just do everything from the beginning and have to figure out who's the accountant and who's the HR and all of that. So it's been interesting creating kind of that platform and the ups and downs and the challenges of spinning out the entities, you know, by itself. But I feel great where we are now with the two children, you know, on their path, and the parents, you know, with this focused vision for CO2 conversion and delivering on the United offtake, which had become the anchor, basically contract for Sambita.
Thinking back to that first time we spoke in 2019, something that is unique about Sambita is you really started with this technology and this process that before necessarily finding the fit for the market. And as you've described, you found multiple fits for how to use the technology in different kind of verticals. So what was it like going through the process of identifying the right way, the right path for the technology? And then maybe just for the people who happen to be living under a rock and don't know what Sambita's technology does, if you could kind of give us an overview of that too.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Like you said, we started, and that was a lot of Tara's research prior, right, on nature-inspired technologies combined with some of my learnings in my previous startup experience in commercializing DNA sequencing in the subsurface. And we kind of said, is this the right time to bring these two industries together, you know, the biotech and upstream energy, you know, industry. And the first use case that we're so excited about was, you know, CO2 conversion, and can CO2 be used as a feedstock, basically. And as we explored that market, you know, we landed on a space application, actually, if you remember, which is to convert the CO2 that astronauts breathe out, turn it into sugar that they could eat. But that was a proof point. We knew that, you know, for this to grow into a big company with a big impact, that is a quite limiting application. But that gave us the room to explore. And that was kind of end of 2018, early 2019. And that coincided with this big wave of energy transition and companies going beyond just doing, you know, methane detection and flaring prevention to focusing on CO2. And beyond just CO2 sequestration and EOR and thinking about what else can we do. And so we were prepared at that time to basically have that option on the table for CO2 utilization. But that didn't happen just like naturally. It was proactively looking for that and testing with companies to find the right one, which we found in Oxy at the time. So that's the initiation and kind of the process of finding the fine tuning. But what the Sambita does, if I could describe it, is basically genetic engineering and optimization of microbe that could help industries reduce their carbon and environmental footprint. We see industrial biotech as an enabler for natural resource companies of the future to be able to produce basically the same product at the same cost, but with the decreased carbon and environmental footprint. So what I'm talking about is microbes that could eat CO2 and turn it into renewable feedstocks, microbes that could extract lithium from lithium clay or copper from low-grade ore like chalcopyrite, and microbes that could, you know, convert unrecovered oil into hydrogen in the subsurface. If you think about everything that we're doing has something to do with nature, is in relation with nature. And we've never thought that we could actually step in nature in that process and actually optimize what is happening in situ, like in the subsurface or in a heap leach in a mine. But environmental microbiology and biotech and synthetic biology is now available and is giving us the tools to do that. So we want to be the company that goes and finds those applications and translate it from the idea to the science to the technology, and then scaling it up into an actual engineered solution. So that's how we've evolved throughout the years, and we've created the team that has the skill set to go basically through the process. And the core of what we do is based on collaboration. So unlike some of the other companies, for example, we don't intend to have our plants with our logo on the door. We don't have any ego for that. What we care about is for the solutions to come to life. So we would rather partner with Oxy, we'd rather partner with United, and use their expertise in a scale-up and engineering to bring our technologies to life.
I think it's always so interesting to talk to you because sometimes it just sounds like the latest science fiction novel, and then you bring in these very real partnerships that you've already had and are already working with. So it feels way less fictional in that way. So let's talk about some of these partnerships that you mentioned. We'll start with United since you have talked about that, and we did just have Andrew on the podcast about a month ago, who shared kind of the United side of things. But tell me about that partnership and you know, really kind of how it is the reality to this thesis of, you know, working with companies to make the technology a reality.
Yeah, so that's a very interesting example because here's an airline company, and sustainable aviation fuel is the pathway for decarbonizing aviation. But if you look at a company like United, they're not a chemical company, or they don't like go make plants to make the fuel, right? So they rely on other segments of the industry for doing that. But because there are bottlenecks in the market to supply the feedstock to be turned into SAF, they've had the foresight to say, okay, we need to help expand the possibilities. And that's why they have started the venture fund and making investments in next generation technologies for sustainable aviation fuel, one of which being Cemvita. And so what we have is these microbes that you feed them waste carbon, and as they grow, they basically produce, it's like oil or lipids, as we call it, inside their body. And then we extract that oil. And that oil is quite similar to soybean oil. And so today, when they make sustainable aviation fuel, they use soybean oil as well as animal fat and use cooking oil. But those things are not scalable for the demand that sustainable aviation fuel has. So that's why United is excited about that partnership. And the way the agreement is set up, we have an offtake agreement with United, which is for 1 billion gallons of sustainable aviation fuel across 20 years. And that allows us then to go partner up with chemical companies like Oxy, with through OxyChem or others, to build those plants that use our technology and scale it up to produce the oil and turn it into SAF and give it to United. So you could see this is an example of an end user coming down into the supply chain to help push the technology so that they could achieve their goals, you know. So in this case, the agreement is set up basically from 29 to 49, we deliver to United, and that's just in time for the 2050 goals. And I think we're going to see more examples of this with consumer-facing companies that have a demand for their own feedstocks and ingredients, coming, you know, deeper into the space to collaborate with technology companies, other partners, to push for sustainable solutions.
Yeah, I do feel like that's not super common yet, but I like that you're saying that we're going to see more of that because the idea of a company like reversing and going back down to the technology, I just feel like it doesn't happen very often. And you've had some really great success with corporate partners, and I want to talk about that more in a bit, but I want to talk about the Gulf Hydrogen too. So tell me about, you know, the opportunities you've had this year to develop that, you know, spin-off company and also that technology and pilot plant.
Yeah, exactly. So with Gulf Hydrogen is another example, but we have I would say our specialty is actually setting up partnerships that are creative, that are meaningful, that are win-win scenarios. So in the case of Gulf Hydrogen, we did a lot of the legwork in the R&D across the past 3 years to build the technology, and then we tested it in the Permian Basin last year, and it worked. And that was all Cemvita doing the work. But then we said, okay, now for us to go and deploy this in a more of a commercial and pre-commercial setup, we have to build this end-to-end solution. what is our strength and where is it that we're going to leverage partnerships? Our strength is in optimizing the microbes and making sure they function within the environment. So in that case, it's within the subsurface environment. Now, when it comes to oil field logistics, for example, or setting up manifolds and surface and pipeline to make sure everything is done safely and operational expertise and excellence that goes into that, that is not our background. So there's a lot of companies that have been doing that across the past, 50 to 80 years. So it just makes more sense for us to partner up. And that's why we did the partnership with ChampionX, which we announced just a few weeks back. So that really is a great example of a win-win scenario. And it really helps accelerate the deployment of the technology so that we don't have to go through the learning curve of oil field logistics. And they could leverage the expertise that we have and the technology that we have for subsurface transformation of the undercovered hydrocarbon to hydrogen. And so that's Gold Hydrogen. And what we're doing right now, we're getting ready for our pre-commercial field trial, which is going to be in Canada in Q1. And that's where we go into what is called, it's like an old water flood injector and producer. And we turn the reservoir into a bioreactor that produces hydrogen. Our estimation is at a cost of less than $1 per kg per kilogram, which is quite amazing, quite comparable to carbon footprint comparable to green hydrogen. So there could be a way to basically reinvent this existing infrastructure in the subsurface that is end of life, about to become a stranded asset, about to become liability for companies because they have to spend more money to plug and abandon them, some of which end up causing more problems because they emit methane. As you know, there's a lot of orphan wells and abandoned wells in the US that emit methane. So this is a way to get ahead of that trend and give these assets a new life in a way that also helps with the energy transition.
Well, I think the hydrogen space is so fascinating, and the role Cemvita, or I guess the section of it that Cemvita is playing a role in, is in gold specifically, which I wonder if you can explain much better than I, the value in gold versus, other of the rainbow of hydrogen. It's all about, how it's produced, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So, it's called gold hydrogen because, I come from an oil and gas background. So oil used to be the black gold, and oil used to be basically what people call fossil fuel, right? And if you think about it, it's not always used as fuel. As a matter of fact, a lot of the use cases for oil as a fuel is going to be replaced by just electrification and other technologies. But oil would still be a feedstock for petrochemical plants because we still have to build things. And the question that we asked was, do we have to bring the oil to surface to be able to use it as a feedstock? Or can we actually go into places where we could in situ, in the subsurface, use the oil as a feedstock with our microbes and turn it into a product that we want, in that case, hydrogen? So that's how gold hydrogen was born. And what I like about it is that it takes the reactions to subsurface, which means you don't have to spend the capex and create more emissions in the process of building new things and using concrete and steel to build a new facility. Also, it gives oil and gas a driver's seat, basically position in the hydrogen economy, as opposed to only doing the capture and storage for blue hydrogen, or having to go gain the expertise to do green hydrogen. Because those are different tracks, but upstream, geologists and petroleum engineers and geophysicists, they're more in tune with this adjacent knowledge for gold hydrogen. We still need all of those expertise, but it's used in a different way. Similar to how, think about what Fervo is doing in geothermal, right? You still have the same expertise, but it's used in a different way. So I love those kind of ideas that reinvents the industry, but in a way that it still uses the existing, talent. Because when I think about existing infrastructure, we also have to think about existing talent and the learning curve that we've had about the subsurface, How could we create new use cases for the subsurface beyond just a storage, but as a place where we could do reactions? And so Gold Hydrogen is an example of that. And we have a bigger vision for subsurface biomanufacturing that goes beyond hydrogen, but that's the starting point.
Yeah, well, my next question was going to be what's next. So we've talked about some of the verticals you've identified as being, you know, really great streets to go down for some of this technology, but there's really a lot out there and a lot of potential. So when you think of the next ways of expanding and specifically other verticals, what comes to top of mind to at least explore?
Yeah, so I don't think we don't have in the plans to create new verticals. I think it's mostly commercializing what we have, and especially now because we have the Gold Hydrogen and Endolith has spun out and well set up and kind of funded. Simbita is going to focus on basically commercializing the sustainable feedstock business with CO2 utilization. And next step for us is we're doing the work for the engineering package for the pre-commercial demo plant for that. So that's a bulk of the activity for next year. You know, I was telling our team this past year was all about resiliency because it was very kind of a chaotic environment and market in terms of the startups and fundraising, and we've kind of found our way. And this next year is all about focused execution. So building out, starting the process for building out that pre-commercial demo plant is a example of that beyond this 55,000 liter pilot plant that we already have. Gold hydrogen field trial, I think, is a huge milestone for next year because that would prove what's possible and then would give us the ammunition to start to implement the actual big vision for that and going after different geographies in different areas. And then on the Endolith side, a lot of the work that they're doing is proving out the copper bioleaching. So we do this big column test, and that's something that's ongoing, and they'll have that data available by next year. Those are some of the things that I'm excited about going into 2024. I think also we're, you know, kind of graduating from this startup phase into some of the, you know, big company establishing and processes. And some of this I'm realizing because some of the things are becoming more red tapey even here. And we're becoming slow in some ways, which is a sign to, you know, reset and make sure we don't use the agility of a startup. But that's the balance in keeping what's exciting about being a startup, but also putting a lot of checks and balances and processes for focused execution in place the same way that big companies have, you know, figured out in a way that it could scale.
That's so true that this is your kind of startup plus, you know, like you're entering that next phase. When you think of, you know, everything you've just outlined for being a focus in 2024 and growing out of that startup phase, but still maintaining the kind of culture and momentum, what are your biggest challenge and how are you addressing them?
I think the biggest challenge is going to be the mind shift from the exploring new ideas and being very open to engaging and changing the mindset to focused execution. Because we did a lot of that across the past few years to really lock in on what is that product market fit. And we found that now, but now it's about building it. So it basically pushes us in a different way. You know, and we already started the process, the capabilities that we need are going to be different than before, right? The conversations are going to be different. For example, we may not necessarily be looking to add new customers, to our partnerships. We'll look more for execution partners. And so that changes also the thinking. And that focused execution, I think, is going to be really a bit of a mind shift for myself, for our team. And I think it's going to be a challenge also to make sure we don't lose that agility of being a startup and executing that way as we go through the process. Because you need to bring a lot of people who have a lot of experience in this space and working with EPC companies, but we're still, you know, not that old. So we want to make sure that we maintain the excitement around that because that's required to to get, talent to join us.
Yeah, it is funny because, we're talking about you growing out of a startup phase and it's still, around a 6-year-old company, which is startup phase for a lot of companies, but not a lot of startups have spin-off startups already too. So Symphede is a whole different ball game in a lot of those ways, which brings me back to the topic of partnerships. I know recently we had a panel on figuring out the best ways to go about these partnerships, and a lot of Houston startups, energy transition startups, have it on their 2024 to-do list to get these partnerships. So I wonder if you had advice for them and any other kind of observations and thoughts about that, about navigating that, finding corporate partners and finding the ones that are going to be the best fit.
Yeah, I would say what I've been doing is I've been reading basically this is the time where companies are publishing the reports for the year, right? And they lay out their strategy, they lay out their focus areas. So it's an easy way for startups to digest that and kind of see, okay, what is really the need and build that into their strategy for next year and reach out to these people. Hey, chief sustainability officer at so and so company, I read your report. I know that this area is a focus area moving forward. This is what we have, and this is how we could help, because this has to make sense as far as the partnerships, but it is on the startups to do the legwork to bring something to the table that solves a problem for the big company or basically has that piece of the puzzle that they're looking for. And like I've said on the panel that we had too, companies have never been open-minded as they are now the same way. So they want to collaborate. And it's just about framing the partnerships to create those kind of a win-win situations and bring that sense of innovation to the big company and leverage and get help from their expertise in the scale-up and engineering in the process. So framing that is, I think, the big thing that any kind of a startup executive team, CEO, BD should really have that expertise, but it starts with understanding what the company needs, and that's why we're suggesting reading those reports at this time of the year is a good start.
What about navigating the different types of ways you're partnering? Because I know, like for instance, with United, that started as an investment and then turned into this offtake well down the road. But taking an open mind kind of thing, and not just going in and being like, I need an investment or I need a pilot, and just what other avenues should they think of?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question. I think it depends what the setup of a company is, their funding strategy. We found the value in working with CVCs for that reason. Some they'll like to invest, and then that leads to a commercial relationship. Some would like to start a commercial relationship, and then that leads to an investment. And sometimes they happen at the same time. You do the investment, and then in the side letter, you negotiate a commercial deal. It also is stage dependent. These things are more difficult to do early on. Early on, it's easier to just start with the investment before then you earn the trust to be able to do a commercial relationship. And that's what it takes to just the time to show them what is possible, do some kind of early stage pilots to do it. So I think learning about what is the process for a company to engage and do pilots with startups is a big part of that. And then around that, the company could position themselves. One thing I've said always is it's easy for especially early stage startups to think that the big companies are the place to start because they think, oh, if you get this big company and have their logo, that helps us a lot. But there's a lot of smaller companies. And that is should be the first place that you go. And once you have some of those, then you go to the BPs and Chevrons and Shells of the world. So that's a bit of a thing that I've realized it's not obvious for especially if entrepreneurs who come from outside of industry or Houston. So that's what we found helpful in earning the trust to then be able to go to the bigger and bigger clients.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, at the end of the day, none of these companies operate in the same way. So I think that, keeping and doing your homework is super important. Well, we've covered a lot already, but one thing I wanted to talk to you about is COP28, since I know you're fresh off of that. I know nothing about it as it is not taking place in Houston, of course, but Tell me about your experience with that, and I don't know what you want to share about what you've learned and what you're bringing back and bringing into your company.
I'm fresh out of that in a way that I'm still jet lagged. I haven't had enough time to get back to normal, but it was a pretty amazing experience. One thing I noticed was, and you've been to CERAWeek a few times, and you've seen how it went from this executive talk meeting to Agora really stealing the show and becoming this big thing that it is. I think that happened this year at COP, where prior you had all this officials and government agencies doing negotiations, but this year you had this massive section just for technology and innovation and sustainability. I think that would become a theme for COP 29 in Azerbaijan and beyond, to bring entrepreneurs, technology people and investors really participating in the event. So I'm so glad that I had the opportunity to go and experience that. I had some observations that maybe I could quickly share. One thing I was curious about was if there's going to be momentum built around not just caring about carbon emissions, but also about the environmental footprint of industries. And I think that was definitely there. I sat through many panels where that was front and center. One of the things specifically that I learned is about this new framework for what's called TNFD, which is a Task Force on Nature-Related Financial Disclosures, which is kind of a comparable to TCFD, which was introduced a few years back. And so TNFD is a new framework to capture non-carbon emissions related aspects of an impact on the environment, such as biodiversity loss, for example. So that's quite interesting. I learned about language that people use around, nature positive tech, or someone on the panel used the nature tech as an aspect of that. So that was quite interesting. And also, I think a lot of that in Europe is already shaping up, but it hasn't really made its way to US yet. So I think within the next year or two, we're going to see more of those conversations make their way to US, the same way they happen with a lot of the climate tech and that in the past few years. Some of that is also driven by COP30 being in Brazil and focused on biodiversity. So I think between now and then, there's going to be more initiatives on biodiversity. The other one was there was a lot of support for nuclear energy. Attended several sessions where there's a lot of new initiatives. One aspect of that is obviously to lower the cost and carbon intensity of power. But what I'm interested in is so many of other climate tech applications that are enabled once you have low cost and low carbon power, from nuclear energy. So that would be really interesting to watch that space. And then one last thing was, we've had this kind of a spectrum of from environmentalists to industry advocates and all coming together. And so what they call advocacy, for example, right? But this year there was a lot of focus on what they called actionism instead of activism. And so the point was let's all come together, everyone, no matter where you come from, let's focus on what actions can we take. So that was interesting. And even they had several stages where people had the chance to speak about basically the actions that could be taken. So I was interesting, I think, bringing people in a different way together. And so we'll see how that translates into actions from here on. But all interesting observations from COP28.
Yeah, I think something that I feel like I've seen more of as I've been more in the thick of the energy transition trends, it almost feels like there's always a new buzzy sector, I guess, within, it's hydrogen sometimes, it was kind of carbon capture for a while, and it's very obvious we need all of these things to really make the biggest impact. But kind of boiling down your observations from COP28 and looking forward to 2024, what do you feel are going to be like the it words and terms and trends for energy transition and climate tech?
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I mean, especially when it comes to technologies, they go through this hype cycle, right? And once you start hearing less about something, is it a good news? Meaning that, okay, that's now boring. That's translated into use cases and it's being done. It's not a big deal anymore. Or is bad news? Means that this that should not never been hyped. It didn't work. It just kind of going away. I think from my point of view, a lot of it is a lot of the work, the discussions, the projects that has been done across the past few years. Now this is the time that those projects, the rubber meets the road, right? So those projects need to be built and scaled. So I think everyone is going to be looking for those signs in what projects are launched. What is the capacity, either if it's for power generation, for amount of CO2 that's been captured, utilized. And really that is what is going to start to separate the winners from the losers in this space, is the ability to execute and build and scale. And we also see that in a lot of the, for example, sources of funding from the government, it gone from supporting a lot of early stage ideas to now there's more support for building pilot plants and scaling up. And that makes logical sense because when you think about the 1.5 degree goal, the goals the companies have that they set for, say, for 2030, that's around the corner. And so everyone is stressed to start to scale this project. So I think that really a scale up and execution is going to be really the theme, whether if it's for CCUS or for hydrogen, for any other the other techs.
Yeah, I think it's kind of exciting and scary because, what is going to deliver and if that hype cycle observation of the hype go away because it's normal now and we've tackled it or it's not feasible and it just kind of slowly died in the background. It's scary because it's like, which is it? But do you think the timelines have shortened now that there is that pressing deadline of 2030? Do you feel like now it's more corporates are looking to startups with their technology? They're ready to dish out the funding to support. They're ready to back a pilot plant. I know for years we've talked about how energy companies have been slow to mobilize new technology. Has that changed in your experience?
That's a tough question. I think it really depends. Some companies, yes, others not. And there's some companies they're still not doing anything. I would say generally there's more support. More companies have now CVCs. They have now energy transition strategy. The other thing is, it's not like the big companies are just waiting for startups to come up with ideas. Like they have their own engines of R&D and innovation that have started working also since a few years back in this space. And those ideas are not coming to fruition. So they're doing their own programs and scale-ups too. I think generally for those who want to come into this space now, there's more data to go by in kind of to set up their strategy. But I think if you were to just compare, say, with last year, yes, there's been more support. Is that all enough, corresponding to the need and where we need to get to? Probably not. Probably we need to see more. And like I said on the panel that we had, we just need to do more, like do more pilots and figure things out and scale up faster. But probably I would always say that whether it's now or next year when we talk. But generally, I think if you have a good idea, solid technology, science, with the right people, could commercialize and have that pathway to commercialization based on the techno-economic and life cycle, there is support available, funding available. And the one thing I would say that I'm waiting to unlock is all the capital that is in oil and gas private equity that is waiting for more projects to get into that first of a kind space. Beyond, kind of the de-risk solar and wind, but this new space like CCUS and hydrogen and battery storage and all of that. So I think from 24 and on, you're going to see more of those companies and projects get into that space and started to unlocking that source of capital. So that's going to drive a whole different way of exciting momentum into that space. And that could accelerate things towards hitting those goals by 2030.
No, I don't know if you know the answer, but how, what's the spark that will unlock that private equity money? Is it the, more actions from the corporations kind of leading the way, or what's it going to take for,
I think,
PE?
yeah, it's a, so what has been done so far is a lot of them, they have set up these earlier funds like climate fund, impact fund, just to be able to start writing smaller checks to test out that area and push some of those companies to come to that de-risked first of a kind stage sooner so that they could write bigger checks. I think what could change is if those companies deliver, if they're successful and there's more examples of these big private equity groups say we started here and now boom, this company made it to this next gate and we wrote this like $100 million check. Then they're just going to do more of that because that proves the model. So that's one thing, and that only happens by time. I think the other part is around risk-taking appetite from them, because if you've been kind of evaluating technology based on performance of the numbers as opposed to looking at the de-risking that needs to happen in the tech, those are very different, right? The private equity versus VC. And right now we have a bit of a hybrid thing going on. I think maybe there's some new categories that they could write bigger checks, but kind of combine the best of both, and not from the point of view of we write a small check, then we write the big check, but fill that gap because there aren't many funds that are in between that do like Series B type infrastructure. So I've seen more of those popping up, but I think they've written some checks, and as those are successful, that's just gonna unlock even more capital into that space, and that's kind of where we are, right? And I've been exploring that, and so for next year, hopefully, we'll be one of those companies. But yeah, and then I mean, you could be surprised; it could be new sources of funding as well, especially in Houston with the wealth that has been generated through oil and gas and else, but has really not been used in this space yet.
Yeah, I think broadly the ecosystem and the venture world is looking forward to a very different 2024 in general, but definitely in the energy transition space. So thank you so much for all of these observations. I think you really bring such a great perspective, and of course it's always great to hear from you about Synthita and all of the major milestones you've reached both this year and in years past. So thank you so much for joining me.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Happy to be back anytime.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Houston Innovators Podcast. Don't forget to hit subscribe so you don't miss next week's edition, and check out innovationmap.com for the latest Houston startup and innovation news. Hi, I'm Kristen Bell. And if you know my husband, Dax, then you also know he loves shopping for a car. Selling a car? Not so much.
We're really doing this, huh?
Thankfully, Carvana makes it easy. Answer a few questions, put in your VIN or license, and done. We sold ours in minutes this morning, and they'll come pick it up and pay us this afternoon.
Goodbye, Truckee.
Of course, we kept the favorite.
Hello, other Truckee.
Sell your car with Carvana today. Terms and conditions apply.